Welcome to the Farming Matters Conference brought to you by Land to Market Australia, the co-op that verifies on-farm ecological improvement. I'm Rebecca Gorman, a member of the co-op and conference MC. The conference had a really great collaborative energy and brought together farmers, business leaders and academics to discuss the benefits of regenerative agriculture and its potential to provide solutions to global challenges. The four sessions explored a wide range of topics, which we hope provide fuel for your farming journey. Let's settle ourselves and begin with our welcome to country from Dr. Yao Mimbira. And to introduce him, his longtime friend and academic associate, Ian Coughlan, who with his wife, Jill, runs two local farms on holistic principles. Thank you, Ian.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Yao Mimbira, who is kindly known as Yao. I've known Yao for many years as a friend and as a colleague at Charles Sturt University, where Yao graduated with honours and then went on to achieve a PhD, wherein he looked at the cultural heritage of his Wiradjuri people. Yao is an elder of Wiradjuri. The Wiradjuri people have walked upon these lands for tens of thousands of years, so we're newcomers to this country that they've walked upon for so long. The country that they walked upon softly, they nourished. It was rich in woodlands, forests, grasslands. It teemed with wildlife, both below the ground and above the ground. So it was a country which had all the things which I guess we aspire to have. The Wiradjuri people geographically spanned north to Dubbo and their language, south to Benalla and Shepparton, and east to Bathurst, where they first encountered white explorers and white settlers. They did nourish the land, and we're the beneficiaries of that nourishment. Knowing Yao at university, Yao was often seen talking to people in a timeless sort of fashion, and he gave us the greatest gift of all, which is time. And if we can make time timeless, it's all the more richer. So with those few notes, I would like to welcome Yao and thank him for being with us here today. Thank you, Yao.
Morning, everyone. There's more than three people out there, isn't there? Morning, everyone.
Morning.
Yeah, that's a lot better, isn't it? Yeah. My name's Yao Mimbira. I'm a representative of the Wiradjuri Council of Elders and the Wiradjuri Nation. And on behalf of the Wiradjuri Council of Elders, Wombarnagoo, Wiradjuri Noorumbung, welcome to Wiradjuri Country. My little chat with you today is about an area of land east of Albury, known as Mungabaruna Reserve. In the year 2000, I came to Albury from Sydney in 1996 as a distance education student for environmental sciences. And I became a lecturer for Charles Sturt University 12 months after I started uni. And in environmental sciences got me interested in looking after country. So the area east of Albury, known as Mungabaruna Reserve, was an area very special to Wiradjuri peoples. And after doing a little bit of research, I come across some diaries by Hewman Hovell, who said that Mungabaruna looked like an English country garden. It was that well looked after. But it had deteriorated. So I decided to do something about it in the year 2000. And I wanted to revegetate and rehabilitate this area of land to get it back to something like Hewman Hovell had described. The consultation processes were a little bit over the top of my head. I'd done about 5,000 to 8,000 pamphlets to let community people know what it is that we were going to do out there. That was part of the consultation processes. Because we were going to set fire to country and we wanted everybody to know that, you know, it wasn't a bushfire, it was us starting it. And I invited people to participate in this project. Albury City Council at the time were adjusting the area out to cattle, and the lagoons out there, the wetlands out there, were just completely black. You couldn't see anything in the water. A huge amount of Scotch thistles and introduced species of weeds and everything that were out there was just absolutely terrible. So I approached Albury City Council and asked them to take the cattle off, and they wouldn't do it. So I approached the National Heritage Trust for some funding, number one, for the plants that I wanted to put out there, but number two, to build a fence so that when we planted, the cows couldn't get in there and eat all the plants. That was in the year 2000, and we had a big flood. Now, I had the fence up. Prior to the flooding, I ended up with about four people out of 5,000 to 8,000 leaflets that I dropped in letterboxes come out to give me a hand. About four. I went out there. I used to go out there after uni and check on the fence and everything, and then I'd come back in the morning before I went to uni. I'd go out to Mungaverina Reserve and check on the fence. And every time that I went out there, somebody had come along and snipped up all the tie wire that was holding the fence up. And they were getting ready to take the whole fence away. So before I could go home or before I could go to work, I had to repair the fence. I went out there one day and there was 35 metres of fence missing. I found the 35 metres of fence in the Murray River, and I had to drag that out and put it back up again. I went out the next day and they'd stolen the gate. So now that we couldn't stop the cattle from getting in there. So I approached Albury City Council and they still didn't want to take the cattle off. When the floods came through, they pushed all the debris up against the fence and the fence was laying over on the ground. And I approached Albury City Council again, and to their credit this time they said, yeah, we'll take the cattle off. So I could take the fence down. I invited schools to bring school children along to help with the planting process, and I was told in no uncertain terms that I wasn't to give them red cordial. I'm serious. They said, under no circumstances, give them red cordial. I think on day one we went through about 6 litres of red cordial. And I tell you what, little kids, they can plant really fast when they've got red cordial. We planted approximately 11,400, I think, native plants and wetland species and river red gums, etc. But what I didn't know, and I didn't ask anybody, and I should have, and this is what I'm trying to get at here, I didn't ask them what the floodwaters were going to do when they receded, what was going to grow back. And we'd already gone through and done the burn so that we could have an area where we could plant. I didn't realise just how quick river red gums grow. We ended up with approximately 5,000 to 10,000 regrowth river red gums, and you couldn't walk through them. They were that thick, that close together. In the end, though, I had 500 school children come out. It cost me a fortune in red cordial. And 500 school kids come out and planted trees out there. And it was absolutely brilliant. And I promised each and every one of those school children that if they put a plant in the ground, their name would go up on a plaque. And so I had a plaque made up and I had 500 school children's names on it. And while we're doing all of this, signs were being stolen. Signs that we'd put up informing the local community of what it was that we were doing and everything like that, and contact numbers of people. People were stealing the signs. They stole the picnic tables. They four-wheel drive people were coming in and driving all over the place. Somebody stole the sign with the 500 school children's names on it. And we don't know where it is. It's gone now. But the reason that I put those names on there was so that those children could grab mum and dad or grab uncle and auntie or grandma and grandpa and come down and say, I planted these trees. But there's no sign. It's gone. I went out there the other day. Mungaverina Reserve has now been designated an Aboriginal place. We now have a working group in place that consists of Wiradjuri elders and young people, and we are now going to rehabilitate and revegetate the area once more. And we're working on the terms of reference at the moment. But the reason that I tell you this story, my friends, is because there's three things here. There's the consultation processes. I didn't consult wide enough, and I didn't consult with the appropriate people at all times, and I should have. There's also planting, seed planting. When you sit down and consult with somebody and you listen to what they've got to say, they're planting little seeds. But how you nurture those seeds is entirely up to you. They may tell you something, and you consult with, you know, 10, 15 people. They've all got a different slant on things. And what they tell you then it becomes up to you, how you do it. So that's my message, consultation, planting seeds, and how you nurture those seeds. On behalf of the Wiradjuri Council of Elders and the local Wiradjuri community and Nanganagu, Kare Binal Billas, Kare Binal Billas Nanganagu. That means look after the land and the rivers, and the land and the rivers will look after you. Thank you very much.
Now, to the Savory Institute. Alan Savory would have been here in person. He was ready to come with the whole Savory team last year, and of course you know why they didn't. And so they are sending a message, which is kind of quite appropriate. We're all used to looking at each other on Zoom, so we'll be looking at Alan effectively on Zoom.
Thank you for the opportunity to address your conference today. I'm really sorry I'm not with you, as I know many of you, I'm sure, but I'm talking to myself on the phone and feeling a bit like an idiot in this COVID time we live in. We all know the situation we face too well for me to spend time on it, so just let me summarise. Worldwide, we face desertification, megafires and climate change, now accelerating as they feed on one another. While people in the UK, France or Japan or most of Europe face only climate change, you Australians face all three. And countries like China or Pakistan face two of them, desertification and climate change. Globally, we face them all. You know that without the production of food and fibre from the world's land and water, which we commonly call agriculture, we cannot have a church, an orchestra, a choir, an army, a city, an economy, or any business. It is the basis of civilization. You know that no business or economy can ever be sustainable until agriculture is. And thus, of course, farming matters. So now, many of you are regenerative agricultural practices. You know about our land to market program, ensuring good practices along the entire chain of production to the best of our ability. And many of you are hopefully involved in our ecological outcome verification program, providing quality assurance to all consumers that what they eat or wear was produced in a way that is truly regenerating the environment. Now, you are at the forefront in advocating better agricultural practices to the public and to your government. What more could be needed? What more could or should you do? That is what I want to talk about today. I will refer to this issue of desertification, megafires, and climate change simply as climate change to avoid being too repetitive. They are all together. In preparing what to say today that could be truly helpful rather than just another entertaining talk to you who already know that farming matters, I reverted to the purpose of the Savory Institute and its global network, which is to get the holistic management framework into global consciousness to offer hope for future generations facing climate change. Now, as I speak, no nation in the world is yet addressing the cause of climate change. If we continue as we are today with no nation, including Australia, doing anything to address the cause of climate change, the collapse of civilization is inevitable. Of such deep concern and danger is the problem that young Australians, as you know, are for the first time in history demanding your government must act. But what action? This is a question on which the future of every Australian and ultimately every human depends. We all know that we cannot solve a problem without addressing the cause of the problem. Common sense 101. So what is the cause of climate change that your Prime Minister and Cabinet have to address? Why has no government in any nation, not only yours, not addressed the cause of the problem long ago? This, I believe, is simply because political leaders believe and are told by experts that climate change is mainly caused by excessive carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases from fossil fuels and from livestock. And they are bombarded with a cacophony of views about what they should do. This chaotic confusion of advice to world leaders we have witnessed with a succession of 25 failed international conferences on climate change, resulting in confusion and conflicting advice to the world's political leaders. Your Prime Minister and Cabinet are in the same position as are all governments, whether democracies or dictatorships. Political leaders frankly have no idea what to do other than to appoint committees, to buy time, and to try to steer a safe political course through a minefield of conflicting pressures and expert advice. There is a reason for such chaos and confusion and lack of effective leadership by politicians, as I will explain. For thousands of years, we denied the role of humans while blaming livestock for causing desertification. And during my life, we have denied the role, our role in climate change, while adding fossil fuels as well as livestock to the things that we blame. Thankfully, during the last year or so almost, all scientists have finally acknowledged that humans are causing climate change. To me, this is wonderful news, because this means there is one cause and not several, as we believed. If we are causing climate change, as now acknowledged, then management is the single cause, because we are a tool-using species, the only species managing our global environment using tools. None of you listening now, if forbidden to use a tool of some sort, can even drink water or milk unless you go to the nearest river or cow and suck with your mouth. How we make the management decisions governing our actions and how we use the few tools we have is the cause of climate change. While livestock and fossil fuels are involved, it is not them, but how we manage them that is causing climate change. Because this is so vital for the future of humanity, let me repeat that. With scientists now acknowledging that humans are causing climate change, we now know we have only one cause that we have to address to succeed in solving the problem. And that is how we manage our natural resources on a global scale. We either address the management causing climate change, or we continue to blame one another and our resources, and thus ensure over time the collapse of civilization, a collapse with increasingly violent weather, mass emigration of environmental refugees, foodless cities, and violent conflict and suffering beyond imagination. It is that simple. Now, what qualifies an old man like me to even be talking to you today about the management causing climate change. Why should you heed anything I say when I know so little about oil, coal, carbon, methane, soils, crops, livestock, fisheries, forestry, or any aspect of agriculture? I have no expertise in any of these things, and I'm in awe of those of you who know so much more than I ever will about those things. With no time to explain, let me just say this. What the world's scientists have now acknowledged, I stress through no wisdom on my part, and for various reasons and circumstances, I came to realize 65 years ago, when I was observing even future national parks breaking down under our management as professional ecologists. Starting in the 1950s and working with some of the world's top ecologists like Sir Frank Fraser Darling and American Fulbright scholars, Professors Mosman and Dasman, who were mentors and colleagues, and later with hundreds and then thousands of people, we had, by 1984, broken through with an understanding of the cause and thus the likely remedy to global desertification and, coincidentally, climate change. It was then that I wrote the first edition of the textbook Holistic Management, in which I quoted American scientists and World Bank colleagues I was working with, stating, and I'm quoting now, "We now recognize that unsound resource management is universal in the United States. And frankly, we realized it was the same in every nation." When I say we, to whom am I referring? As few things are ever accomplished or discovered by any individual alone. I am referring to over 2,000 scientists, World Bank economists, university professors and faculty members, and policymakers that I was commissioned to put through a week of training over a two-year period in the use of the holistic management framework I had begun developing in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. And I was commissioned to do this by far-sighted officials in the Soil Conservation Service of the United States. Without this incredible concentration of minds, skills, and professions, all focused on the problem for 2 years, I believe we could not have isolated the cause as we did. Today, 38 years later, I can summarize for you more clearly than I could in those early days of glimmering of understanding. First, with management causing climate change, we need to recognize the difference between the things that we produce or make and those we manage. All of society believes we manage thousands, perhaps millions of things, and thus it is very difficult to focus on which of those is causing climate change. You know, as farmers, that you produce corn or maize, rice, beans, meat, milk, wool, leather, cotton, timber, wine, with the rest of society producing music, art, literature, and making billions of artifacts, from toothpicks and pencils to chemicals, vehicles, planes, computers, bridges, roads, bombs, cathedrals, to space capsules. And we use energy that we produce from nature, coal, oil, gas, nuclear, biofuels, geothermal, solar, wind, etc., to produce all the food we do and make all the marvelous things we make. Everything that we make or produce, including the food you produce and the energy we produce, has something in common, whether simple or extremely complicated. They end if we stop producing or making. They stop if a battery or fuel runs out, a part breaks or is missing. They do what they're designed to do, and they don't have unpredictable properties. A watch tells you the time. A computer computes. Corn, rice, meat or vegetables feed people. Leather or wool clothe people. And electricity lights our homes. None do unplanned or unexpected things, because that problem lies with the things we manage. Now, nothing that we produce or make is self-organizing, and thus no matter how seemingly complex they might be, as was the robot we recently sent to Mars, they are, in systems science, defined as complicated but not complex. To make or produce all the billions of things we do every year, we use our creativity, our money, and our labor. But as I explained earlier, you cannot even drink milk without a technology. And we have only two tools, technology in its many forms and fire, as I explained in my TED talk on desertification in 2013. So with that being known and cleared out of the way, what do we actually manage that is causing climate change? We manage three things. We manage humans, we manage nature, and we manage economies. We do not make or produce these things, and never will, using technology or fire or any tool, even imaginable. None of these things we manage stops when people die, a part breaks, battery or fuel runs out, thousands of species die, or an economy collapses. No matter how badly they are damaged by deaths, biodiversity loss, or collapse of an economy, all of them continue, but in changed form. This is because everything that we manage is self-organizing with emergent or unpredictable properties. These features, self-organizing with emergent properties in systems science, define complexity. So it is the management of complexity where our problem lies. Now, another distinguishing feature is that while the things we make or produce can be produced independently of one another, humans, institutions, nature, and economy can never be separated. Organizations, including businesses from family farm to large corporation, cannot be managed without simultaneously managing nature and economy. Something we failed to recognize till about 1983, as I mentioned earlier, when we broke through to a clearer understanding. Now, let us look at management at different scales. First, we have the human level, as I call it, of, for example, you, the farmers. As farmers, you can, like all humans, choose to ride a bike to work or change light bulbs. That means you can choose what to produce and how to manage your business, cash flow and farm, nature, soil and biodiversity. However, while this is theoretically true, in practice it is not, because at any given time, an institution, in this case a political party in power, developing policy that controls the economic, legal and regulatory environment of you, in which you farm, is the dominant issue. So let's look at the level of Australian agriculture managed through your institutions. Government, universities, corporations, and agricultural organizations of you farmers. Influencing government, but ultimately by the political party in power, developing policies resulting in laws, regulations, taxes, subsidies, education, research and extension influence that largely dictate to you farmers both what you produce and how you manage nature and your farm's economy. I believe all that I have said so far is simple, undeniable fact. Fact that I acknowledge is not generally recognized, just as it was not recognized by me when I was the president of a political party with my shadow cabinet in Rhodesia decades ago. It was only when the buck stopped with me as the president developing Rhodesia Party manifesto and policies on education, defence, commerce, finance, agriculture, and immigration, and how we would deal with a mounting civil war and world sanctions, that I came to fully understand how politicians develop policy. And later, to understand why this universal way that all governments, dictatorship or democracy, do so is causing climate change. So now let me wrap up. The cause of Australia's desertification and megafires contributing to climate change is your management as farmers in an economic and legislative environment governed by the prevailing policies of the ruling political party. That, I believe, no reputable scientist would any longer dispute. That all governments, dictatorship or democracy, develop policy in the same way explains why agriculture in every nation, America, China, Britain, European Union, Australia, Zimbabwe, or Uruguay, is the most damaging industry ever and contributing so greatly to climate change. What you are doing, providing the gold standard of managing holistically, is wonderful. I urge you to keep doing what you are doing, collaborating with ever-growing numbers of colleagues, expanding the choir, and influencing public opinion and thus politicians. I am not sure how many organisations there are in Australia influencing your government and its agricultural policy, but I did do an internet search and it seems to be you have more than 140 organisations doing so. Some 140 organisations ensures a discordant clamour of voices pressuring or wanting your political leaders to heed their form of agricultural production in the policy. Many of you are involved promoting what your members produce and the way they produce it, be it beef, wool, rice, sugar, fruit, wine, cotton, whatever. Knowing that you cannot address climate change without your political leaders addressing the cause, this poses the obvious question. Are any of us, or any of you, even talking about the cause of climate change? Or are all of us just clamoring for our form that we favour of agricultural production to be included in policy? I believe you know the answer. I believe you will do your grandchildren and your nation a disservice if you settle for only adding your voice to this plethora of voices without also doing all you can to help your Prime Minister and Cabinet develop policy in a way that addresses the cause of climate change. Our purpose at the Savory Institute and in our global network of hubs on six continents is to do all in our power to bring about meaningful change by addressing the root cause of climate change. Not only through focusing on the management of the grasslands, which constitute most of Australia and most of the Earth's land, and supporting regenerative practices, but also by helping world leaders through developing policy to make all agriculture truly regenerative, addressing the cause of climate change. So while you have a great many agricultural and economic experts, as do all nations, the problem lies, as we discovered 38 years ago, with politicians developing policy in the context of any problem, like feeding the nation, or economically competing with other nations, or addressing megafires, or addressing the contribution to gross domestic product of the agricultural industry, or any other problem. Policy, as we discovered and published in the 1980s, needs to be developed in a national holistic context, tying the lives of you Australian farm families and city families to your life-supporting environment. It's a new concept, not found in any branch of science, philosophy, or religion. It's a management concept. So while you don't lack the expertise in agricultural production, I believe that Australia, like other nations, lacks expertise in facilitating the process of developing a national holistic context and subsequently policy in that context. A policy not driven by any problem, but driven by the future of Australians, living in harmony with your environment in an economy that can sustain the nation based on the photosynthetic process, without which no business or city will ever be sustainable, an agricultural policy developed by your Prime Minister, not as a politician, but as a statesman, with the whole nation united and ensuring that the knowledge and skills of your experts, agricultural and economic, is embraced, not as a cacophony of sounds, but in harmony through a national holistic context. This missing piece of our puzzle, our global holistic management network can provide. That is simply the facilitation skill to enable your government and people to develop policy under the leadership of your Premier, without which it cannot be done, because only he has the convening power to initiate and lead the process. So I urge you to go beyond what you're doing so well today. Go the extra mile. Go beyond merely adding another voice to the political pressure. Help your Prime Minister to do what Australian youth are pleading by addressing the cause of climate change. With your help, this can be done in a politically risk-free, statesman-like manner, as I described when I was honoured to present last year's Maloon Memorial Lecture that I'm not going to repeat. Clearly, in that lecture, I went a bridge too far for you Aussies. So now I suggest you take a preliminary step or bridge before Arnhem. That step would be for you, being aware of the cause of climate change, to suggest to your Prime Minister that he assemble a small group consisting of himself and the leaders of other political parties and any advisors he wishes or experts he wishes to attend a one-day retreat to discuss the holistic management framework and policy development process. I would travel across the world to do that, because the first country in the world to begin to address climate change will, I believe, result in a domino effect, saving billions of lives and city-based civilization. As other governments begin to follow suit, and then later to tackle energy policy in the same manner. The downside risk in your suggesting this to your Prime Minister is at worst some time and a few thousand dollars wasted if somehow your Prime Minister decides not to address the cause. I don't believe that would happen. The upside, when no politician in the world knows what to do and no nation is seriously addressing either desertification or climate change, just cannot have a price tag. I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. And once more, I'm sorry I'm not with you as we had planned. I hope that you will do the right thing and go further than providing the gold standard of managing the grasslands of Australia and truly help your Prime Minister to be the first world leader to address climate change facing all nations. Thank you.
The Farming Matters Conference was brought to you by Land to Market Australia and our Ecological Outcome Verification. Through this verification, we help farmers both improve their land and link them through to consumers. You can join the process easily by going to the Land to Market Australia website. Thanks to all our conference sponsors and speakers, links to their details are provided in the episode show notes. To listen to other conference sessions, make sure to subscribe, and to see videos of these podcasts, visit the Land to Market YouTube channel. For more information about upcoming events, check out our Facebook or webpage, landtomarket.com.au. I'm Rebecca Gorman. Thanks for listening.